representing the entire city.
This is BCFM.
BCFM 93.2.
Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is there any real international terrorism, or is it all cooked up by criminal governments to keep us in fear in the post-9/11 world? Are you and I, our police and our politicians, the targets for the most powerful wave of propaganda ever? Well, that's the provocative question put by someone Martin Summers speaks of regularly on this show, General Leonid Ivashov, former head of the Russian Armed Forces. We look at his statement, as well as dig deeper into the 1999 Russian apartment bombings that polonium-poisoned spy Alexander Litvinenko wrote about. He blamed Vladimir Putin for these in his book Blowing Up Russia. Plus, 10 years after the Chief Inspector of Schools recommended all Bristol schools be privatised, and they were, where are we now? We hear from independent mayor candidate and former teacher Christine Townsend. But we start with the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, whispering omerta, omerta under his breath. Are we being ruled by a bunch of the country's most thuggish toffs from Eton and the Bullingdon Club? Journalist Nick Much recently graduated from Oxford, and he didn't like what he saw. And he joins me on the line now. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, Nick. Thanks. First of all, I suppose I should ask you, what was it about your experience at Oxford, and what really triggered your interest in the Bullingdon Club?
So, I mean, I originally got involved just because quite a lot of the national papers, in particular, I did some work for Der Spiegel, the German weekly. But it was something that was kind of very obviously going on everywhere. People were always kind of talking about the Bullingdon Club in hushed whispers. Everyone had kind of seen the photographs of David Cameron. A couple of them got in trouble with the police when I was there. But no one actually knew anything about the club, any of its traditions, any of its history, anything like that. And so I decided, well, something needs to be done about that. So I decided to really, really try and dig as deep into the club, all its histories, all its traditions, but not just that, to work out the links between what people in the club were like then and what they're doing now. And if you can see, and one of the points I try and make, is that a lot of what happens with the Bullingdon Club isn't just sort of youthful indiscretions. These people go on to maintain the connections they made in the Bullingdon Club 20, 30 years later, when they're in high positions in journalism, politics, wherever, financial institutions. List goes on.
Now, I know that one of the things that's really helped in your research massively is discovering a whole load of these Bullingdon Club photographs, because one of the first pictures of David Cameron and George Osborne in the Bullingdon Club was published in the Daily Mail, and I think they got sued for it. So there's obviously a great deal of sensitivity about publishing these pictures of Bullingdon Club photos, people saying, well, it's a private photograph, you're not allowed to, and if you do, we're going to take you to court. And so there's been a reluctance to publish those photographs. But I know you've managed to get loads of these old photos of the Bullingdon Club boys. How did you manage to do that?
So, well, I did quite a large article on about exactly what happened in the Independent about 8 or so months ago. A lot of them were just hanging on the walls of a tailor called Eden Ravenscroft. Now, that's the tailor that makes the very famous Bullingdon outfit, which is reputed to cost around £3,500. And interestingly, I also dug up an old pamphlet called The Rules of the Club, and from 1850. The uniform back then is exactly the same as it was and it is now. Now, effectively, a lot of these photos A lot of some of them circulate online. You can find them in very old image archives. A lot of them are in college archives, so not really publicly accessible except to researchers or professional journalists. But I guess what surprised me was that no one had really done this before, even for the photos that were in public domain, which includes some very famous people, Cecil Rhodes, King Edward VIII. There's another one with Archibald Primrose, Earl of Rosebery, Prime Minister in the 1890s, that have just never been discovered. But the most interesting ones were the ones on the wall of Eden Ravenscroft, especially as one of the photos there was one of David Cameron, which had never been seen before or never been published before.
Now, the Bullingdon started as a cricket club. I couldn't quite believe this, back in the 1780s. But was it really about cricket?
So, and the interesting thing is a lot of their old match logs still survive, and it's very evidently obvious that they weren't very interested in cricket at all. It has them playing a lot of cricket clubs, the Marylebone Cricket Club for one, that says, Bullingdon lose by 9 wickets. Bullingdon out, all out for 64, or in one case, the most recent match register just has Bullingdon gave up the match after a couple of overs. So it was, cricket club was kind of a veneer to give some sort of respectability to it.
It certainly doesn't sound like a dream team to run the country, does it?
No, not particularly. And I think that's one of the things that often comes in for criticism with the club, is that getting into the club is almost entirely dependent on wealth, particularly landed wealth. There is no, you don't have to be particularly intelligent or socially savvy or anything to get into the Bullingdon Club. It is basically just the richest of the rich.
Now, what about this business of Boris Johnson whispering? Well, I didn't whisper it. I was saying it quite loudly. Omerta, omerta. Is that true?
So that's an account I have gotten from a journalist from Sebastian Shakespeare, who now writes Daily Mail. He actually wrote, there's an old book, a very fascinating old book from published in 1988, called The Oxford Myth, which has a contributions from a number of people, one of which is actually Boris Johnson. And he basically, in this, Sebastian Shakespeare writes an article where he interviews someone from David Cameron's Bullingdon Club, gives them an on-the-record interview, and he said that whenever he's tried to talk to this about, with the, discuss this with Boris Johnson in the future, Boris just whispers, omerta, omerta, to him, just means silence, silence, or code of silence. That said, the code of silence is far from inviolable. I've had quite a number of old members speak to me, mainly off the record, and some of them in particular aren't exactly particularly proud of their past. For instance, they kind of wish it had never happened, or now that they see everyone they know from the club in very high positions in society, they might start to feel a little bit embarrassed.
Well, let's look at some of those. There's Lord Halifax, during World War II, was the guy who was seen as the most Nazi British lord, who Rudolf Hess went to try and meet up with in 1941. There's also more modern version of the Bullingdon Club, the Dukes of Norfolk, Northumberland, Westminster, Roxburgh and Buccleuch. Now, I noticed also that the Duke of Buccleuch, back in the Second World War, was close to King George VI as the Lord Steward of the Royal Household, but he accompanied Lord Brockett to celebrate Hitler's 50th birthday. It was a matter of personal delight to Hitler that the Duke, a man who served in the very court of Britain's royal family, was there. And Buccleuch was opposed to any war with the Nazis. When it did break out in 1939, he joined something called the Peace Aims Group to try and urge a truce with Germany, letting Hitler keep all the lands he'd stolen in Europe. So you've got some interesting characters here. More modern one, Rupert Soames, and the Rothschilds family. Jacob Rothschild is apparently worth $7 billion, although a chap called Kevin Carr, who we have on this show quite regularly, Nick, who used to work for the Sunday Times Rich List, would probably disagree. I mean, this really is a pretty impressive list of people, including names like von Bismarck and, as you said, Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah. Some other interesting people, for instance. One is Nicky Oppenheimer, who used to be chairman of chair of De Beers, the mining group that was set up by Cecil Rhodes. It's not just Tories as well. There's a UKIP figure, quite a senior UKIP figure, Stuart Wheeler, who was treasurer of the party until 2014, used to be a large Tory donor, donated quite a lot directly to UKIP, so there's that influence there as well. It's far from just the Tories. Lord Longford, who was a Labour peer until very recently, was in the club in 1925. It's really quite a staggering list. I'm sure others will come to me. Tom Lawson, who was son of Chancellor Nigel Lawson, I did a piece for Byline on what happened there. In 2000, the club got effectively smashed up a marquee, and it took 30 cops to shut that particular party down. Now, this is all verified. It's been reported on. That was reported on in Parliament at the time, except Bullingdon Club, as not that much was known about it then, it never really got that much traction.
Okay, what about stories about the Prime Minister, though, David Cameron? And have there been denials, and have you managed to get to the bottom of any of them?
So there's the one story that everyone knows, or that has been commonly reported by Cameron about Cameron, is how a bunch of them all spent the night in a cell. This was in 1987. Boris was there as well. However, I've managed to get accounts from the time, and Cameron has always denied he was there. Now, that's not true at all. Cameron definitely was there. What happened is they smashed a restaurant window. The police were called. They got chased down into the botanical gardens of Oxford, and a couple of them managed to get away. Of that couple who managed to get away, there was David Cameron and Boris Johnson, who managed to slip down a side street. And one of the quotes that was given about it, this quote wasn't originally gotten by me, this was originally published in the Financial Times about 5 years back, was that they always joked that the two that ran from the police would be the two that ended up running for Parliament and then running the country many, many years later.
I mean, is it fair to say that as part of your Bullingdon Club membership, you're rewarded for doing as much damage as possible, and it's a kind of way of institutionalising bad behaviour?
Well, one of the common allegations that is made is that these people, when they do all these things when they're younger, yes, not only are they encouraged, one of the guys told me that they kind of made a fetish out of doing as much damage as possible. But it's also that if you're a group of 10 very wealthy people who are going to probably go on to very important things in society, everyone's got dirt on each other. It means that everyone will stick together later in life because they all have the dirt on each other. They effectively all have some form of influence, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. But, I mean, it's also a bit worrying, is that they might start doing the same sort of damage to the country and to us.
Yeah. Well, that, I think, probably outside of my expertise, but it's not difficult to draw parallels.
I tell you what, I'll, at this point, Nick, I'll bring in old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. I mean, Martin's an old Oxford student, not the same college. I mean, which college did you go to, Martin?
I went to St Catherine's College. Charwell Polytechnic, as some of the posher colleges used to refer to.
I mean, Nick's come out with a pretty amazing bunch of dirt, I suppose, on these people, and it is worrying. Certainly, if they're encouraged to do damage, to commit crime, in order to have dirt on each other, so that then they can possibly be blackmailed in the future, or they'll keep quiet, as we were hearing the Mafia Omerta sign. But what when these people are let leash on a country, on an economy?
Well, I mean, I think you can compare them to something like the Skull and Bones Society at Yale and Harvard in the US. These elite kind of clubs for the super wealthy, where they, you know, they basically do things which leads to them having dirt on each other, etc. And of course, the Bullingdon Club is not entirely Tory, but pretty much so. I mean, certainly, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, but you have to go to Eton to be in the Bullingdon Club, do you not? Perhaps you could enlighten me there. I was presumed
the majority of people come from Eton, not exclusively, about 70 odd percent do. George Osborne went to St Paul's, and not everyone goes to Eton, but it definitely helps.
Nick, also, what about deaths? Because there have been some deaths associated with the Bullingdon Club, some quite nasty ones, haven't there? And also, I mean, drug taking, it seems a little bit tame compared to talking about the people that have died.
So one story that I found that is all on record, is all, has been through the courts actually, was in 1977, where a couple of guys, and one of them in particular, the driver, were in the Bullingdon Club at the time, and were apparently, according to a source I have, coming back from one of their dinners, and effectively the guy, now I have to make perfectly clear here that he was not convicted of drunk driving. He was convicted of dangerous driving causing death after quite a long trial. Now you can see a nice photo of him in the Bullingdon Club from that exact year. Gets off with a fine and a driving ban, effectively. Now he crashed into a car and he killed four other people, one of which was a Chelsea footballer, quite a well-known guy called Peter Housman. Now, as for why this has never come out, I'm not entirely sure. Either people have kind of kept the omerta about it, or because it was about 10 years before Cameron or Osborne were involved, it's never been directly linked to them. I thought what that showed a bit more is that a lot of these people will do whatever kind of damage to property it is, or damage to life, but almost never suffer any sort of consequences for it, if that makes sense. The police will let them go after a night where they smash a restaurant up. A couple of years ago, a restaurant owner wanted to have the group charged, and the police refused to do it. This was back in 2004. Effectively, it's not even so much what they do, but the fact that they always get away with it.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's almost taken as read the drugs, I suppose. But what about being banned from Oxford? Because I know, they've been to so many different premises where the owners have got fed up with having the place smashed up that they're now having to sometimes actually go outside Oxford to have their events.
No, that happens all the time. They've been banned, I think, since the 1890s from meeting inside Oxford. And sometimes they'll book, for instance, under an assumed name. They would never be able to book somewhere under the Bullingdon Club. The owners just... for instance, the party that I actually witnessed myself last year, they just booked under an assumed name. And generally, if they're found out to be the Bullingdon Club, which happens, they just get kicked out of the establishment.
Now, I suppose one of the most worrying things about this is a bit like that Martin was saying about like the skull and bones in the United States, is that it's not just something that happens at Oxford and a bit of fun that then gets forgotten about, Nick, because I know you've put together some evidence that the Bullingdon Club people regularly meet up, actually, after they've long left Oxford.
Yes, so... And I don't want to, I'm not going to say how I know this, but I know at least two occasions, one of which has been reported was reported, I think, in the Diary of the Standard about 7 years ago, where they all met up to do, this was just when Boris was first running for mayor, so a little bit longer, and about six of them from the same club met up to do a fundraiser for them. I also know that they often, or at least once in the last couple of years, had had a reunion dinner at the house of one of the guys who was in Cameron and Boris's club, and Cameron and Boris were all there for it. Now, you can say, okay, well, they're just catching up with university friends, but when you have people for that same club, you know, writing about them in national newspapers favourably, or you have Cameron, in one case, appointed one of the guys who was in the Bullingdon Club with to oversee a panel on state school spending, it's difficult to say they're just catching up with old friends when it's clear that actually in some cases they may be having influence on policy.
Now, Nick, whereabouts can people follow your work online and keep up with what you're up to? Because I know you did I'll put a link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to your article, recent one in the Daily Beast, which has got a lot of this stuff in it, which really drew my attention to you doing this. I mean, there doesn't seem to be anybody in the London media doing this, just you as a freelance digging it out. But where can we follow your work online?
So I've got quite a large series of pieces coming, of which I've already done about four on byline.com. I want to go through each of the photos, who was in it, if we know anything about what happened there. I'm also a contributor, as you said, to the Daily Beast, and I have been tweeting some of my material out. My Twitter handle is at Nick T Much, M-U-T-C-H.
I think there's also something else worth saying here, and that is that we, you know, failed to identify quite a lot of people in those photos. So we want to kind of have a kind of wanted competition, so people can have a look at those. And if you can identify who they are, some of the individuals who were in the Bullingdon Club sort of 10, 20 years ago, some more recently, it would be quite nice to have a whole list of who they were and then to be able to see those photographs of them.
Here's the really interesting thing is that of all the photos, most of them are named. However, all the photos between 1987 and 1992, when Cameron, Osborne and Boris were in the club, have all had the names scrubbed from the bottom of them. There's one in particular of David Cameron in 1998 where the names have been scrubbed, and none of the other, about two, I managed to identify two or three other people in that photo. The rest of them are unknown. They could be MPs, they could be financiers. There's another one in 1990 where I've not identified anyone. There's one person who I suspect is actually a very high-ranking Tory MP. I'm not going to name them because they've denied it to me, and I haven't had anyone positively identify them for me. But if anyone was to look at the photo and go, oh, that's so-and-so, well, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, let's make sure those are up online somewhere, very easy to have a look at, so people can scan them in, blow up the photos, blow up the faces, and see if they're not in an explosive way, but obviously, you know, to make the faces bigger so you can see exactly who they are. Also, Nick, one of the main reasons that I wanted to get you on to it is because this is extremely damaging to the Tory party to see that so many of their senior people, Boris, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, the Mayor of London, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer are from this club. It does look as if this is basically a little private club running the country.
If I can actually add one more name to that I only discovered recently, is a guy named Philip Dunn, who is a minister. He's Minister for Defence Procurement. So that's another minister who's in the club. I believe there's a couple more that I have yet to find, but that's just another example.
This is some ongoing work, isn't it? Yes, very good that we're talking about education just after we speak to you, because it's like when you leave school, you think you finish your education. No, think again. Because you put a piece together for the Daily Telegraph, didn't you, in the run-up to the elections last year. Just tell us briefly what happened there.
That's effectively true. This was probably about 2 weeks before the election. I had I spoke to two of their very senior reporters, rather not name names, and they told them about the story that I had about all of these photographs, and they were extremely keen to do the story. Came down to Oxford, discussed it with me several times on the phone, probably spent about 3 or 4 hours going over the story with them. All of a sudden, complete radio silence. Wasn't sure why. They never told me why. I called about a week later. They said they'd have to talk to someone high up and see what was happening now. Never heard anything again. That Sunday, which was just before the election, which was where the piece was originally going to be published, it was full of stories about how the Conservative government was the greatest government of all time and George Osborne was the greatest Chancellor since William Gladstone. You can effectively make your own mind.
Well, I think Martin would probably beg to differ. Is George the greatest Chancellor since Gladstone?
No.
Anyway, listen, Nick, that's been fascinating talking to you, and we'll be definitely following your work and hope to have you on again sometime. And let us know if you have any more revelations about these people, because I think we're supposed to be living in a democracy, aren't we? Not in this kind of small club of violent toffs running everything. I'll just leave the final word with you, Nick.
So I guess one thing that I've always tried to put out is that I don't think this is just about how the country is run now. This is the country's history. This goes back to the 1790s, and you've got the most prominent people in the world here. And I think the fact that still people very powerful try and shut all this information down is effectively what really annoys me, is that this is history. This is one of the most kind of essential clubs to understand the British class system. And they effectively don't want the truth about how the British class system runs to be revealed. And that's one thing that I want to try to do, is make that kind of contribution to history effectively by showing this club, for all its faults, and for all its occasional good things, what it is and what its place is in British history.
Okay, Nick Much, freelance journalist at byline.com. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show. Thanks.
Your difference is our strength. On Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
And now I'm joined in the studio by Christine Townsend. Thanks for waiting patiently there, Christine. I know that you have a few things to say about our education system here in Bristol. I just wondered if you just have any comments on what we just heard there, because I'm pretty shocked to hear that that things like the identity of people who are in this bullying club is being kept secret, and that if a newspaper publishes a photograph, they get sued. I think it's something like £20,000-£30,000 the Daily Mail had to pay for just publishing a picture of the Prime Minister. It seems like that should be their job.
Well, yeah, I think I would agree. I'm pretty shocked, really, at how much information this guy is kind of informing us about. But what I find interesting is that clearly these people go back a long way. They were educated at school together because they were all at Eton. They all then went to the same college in Oxford, and now they're all running the government. And it seems that they've got the judicial system and the police in the back pocket of some of that establishment if there are people going to court, and they're not necessarily getting the sentences that ordinary people would get if they did some really serious dangerous driving and killed somebody.
Well, it's bizarre, isn't it, that we're having the same sort of conversation in the first hour with Carla Denyer, the Green councillor, about social justice, just basically to do with big corporations being treated much better than ordinary people who are struggling to survive, just when it comes to things like HMRC. But anyway, look, let's focus down here on the on education here in the city. And I know you're standing as a mayor candidate in May, coming in May. Just what is your platform you're standing on?
Well, it's about exposing the reality of what's going on for our education state sector in the city. Mainly the social selection that has pretty much been around since I was myself educated as a child. But what's happened under the academy system is that has been extended. And we have a two-tier education system, particularly in our secondary sector, and schools are and have been demonstrated over the last couple of years to be using unlawful practice in order to select and take particular children into their school.
Okay, well, look, hang on. You're saying unlawful.
Yeah.
Yes, this is... Let's just clarify here. It's not illegal, it's unlawful. Illegal applies to criminal law,
yep.
Unlawful to civil law. So
yeah.
What are they doing that's unlawful?
Well, there are...
What have they been doing?
Well, there's been 8 investigations in the last 2 years into 7 of which have involved secondary schools. We've got 21 secondary schools in Bristol, 7 of which have been demonstrated to have unlawful practice around the way that they're admitting their students. And anyone that knows anything about schools knows that it's about who your cohort is, because everything about school is set up in order to provide the education for the children that come through the door. That's the point of the school, or I thought that was the point of school. And so if you can put barriers up in front of certain parents so that the children of those parents are not able to negotiate getting in through the door, then the children that you're left with generally have a higher attainment when they come into your school, and they're generally more affluent. And educational research over years and years has demonstrated that those are the children that when they come out the other end get the higher grades.
Well, it's 10 years since the schools commissioner, I think it was chief inspector of schools, called for the failing schools across Bristol to be privatised. So let's have a listen to a report earlier this week on BBC Points West from Martin Jones, where he talks amongst, well, I think the only person he actually talks to in this clip is Paul Jacobs from Bristol City Council.
The former chief inspector of schools was always damning about Bristol.
So you're seriously suggesting that all Bristol state schools should be privatised?
Yes, I think that the evidence to date is that the...
And this is from 10 years ago.
...procedures, the local education authority, has failed the people of Bristol.
But since then, every secondary school in Bristol has been totally or partially rebuilt. The former Speedwell School was reborn as Bristol Brunel Academy 9 years ago. Its results improved dramatically.
I think we're very fortunate here. We have a state-of-the-art building. For me, the big thing is the value for the students. Students come here every day and they realise that actually this wonderful building is built purposely for them to deliver an outstanding education, and they really value that.
That was part of that report by Martin Jones for BBC Points West. Now, Christine Townsend, what are your thoughts about that? Because it sounds as if what we've got here is a pretty good deal. We've got some beautiful buildings. It may be a few things that need tweaking about the way that admissions are organised, or the way that education itself is organised, teachers are organised. But at least we've got some brand spanking new premises to do it in. It's a good start, surely.
Well, we have got some new premises, but a lot of those premises are built on PFI deals, so we're in debt as a result of which is what the PFI dealing was. Actually, the person that spoke there is the current head of Bristol Brunel Academy, BBA. As far as I'm from what I can, yeah. That wasn't Paul Jacobs.
Oh, okay.
But what I would say to that is that actually the results for that school went down last year. So the A to Cs that school achieved last year were 44%, including English and maths. The year before that, in the summer of 2014, they got 48%. So they've actually gone down. And the year before that, they got 45%, and the year before that, they got 45%. So at the very best, Bristol Brunel Academy can be described as plateauing in terms of their A to C results, I'm going to suggest.
I mean, are there differences between, do you think, because, I mean, I think we're right in saying that the best, or the first schools, private schools, to be brought into the national, or to be funded by us, basically, by the Department for Education, were here in Bristol. How have they done? I mean, is it? I think it's Colston Girls School.
It's Colston Girls School and the Bristol Cathedral Choir School.
Right,
yeah.
How have they done?
Well, they've kept pretty much the catchment areas that they had when they were independent schools. So both of those schools are massively oversubscribed every year, but they allocate places to children that don't live in Bristol. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say about Colston Girls is that they ring fence these places. So there are 25% of the places at Colston Girls that every year do not go to Bristol families, regardless of how many families actually want to get in there. You've got a better chance of getting into Colston Girls if you don't live in Bristol, because the numbers inside applying to Bristol are so high. So if we look at Bristol Cathedral, last year they got 88%. A to C grades, which sounds really good, and it is really good, you know, when you say this is the top line 88%. But the thing that I would say about Bristol Cathedral Choir School is that they have less than 7% of their children on free school meals. So what you've got when they're coming into year seven are very high attaining children of affluent families, and you would expect them to be getting 88% at the end. They've only got 12% of their cohort is what you would call disadvantaged, and of those, just under 7% are entitled to free school meals, whereas Bristol Brunel Academy, which is the one that we've just been speaking to, have got 37% of their children that would be considered to be disadvantaged. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying that there are certain schools that are creaming off those children of affluent parents, and certainly the Cathedral Choir School is one of them. Colston Girls is also one of them. They've got just under 13% of their children entitled to free school meals. And look at where both of those schools are. There is no reason for Colston Girls School to only have 12% of their children entitled to free school meals. Where we are here, City Academy is in within walking distance. City Academy's got nearly 70% of their children that are entitled to free school meals. It is not acceptable that this is how schools are operating in this city, and it's being projected out to the public and out to parents and families that whose taxes pay for these schools, that everything is getting better and everything's rosy in our state school system, because it just isn't.
Martin, 70% on free school meals is an enormous amount, but that is it's being concentrated into certain schools like the City Academy where we're sitting now.
Well, that's right. We're getting there used to be a two or three-tier system. You had the independent schools, you had the grammar schools, and then you had the secondary moderns, where most people went, about 80% of children. Now we've got a much more unfair system, where there isn't three levels, there's any number of levels, and the 11 plus, for all its faults, was a relatively meritocratic setup, although of course in fact they there were more girls passing it than boys, and the grammar schools should have been filled up gradually with girls rather than boys. But we've now got selection, which really is just based on manipulating the system. I would argue if Colston Girls' School is going to be funded by the taxpayer, the admissions policy has got to be decided by the relevant authorities. They can't just take the money and then just carry on regardless. In what we've effectively done after the financial crash, the parents of Colston Girls' School probably feeling the pinch, and so we are now paying their school fees for their kids to get the opportunities that they always used to have to pay for, at the same time as we haven't got resources in our inner city schools. It's not fair. It just isn't fair, is it?
Yeah, because, I mean, it did worry me, this report on Points West, because it sort of paints this picture of everything being rosy. Everything's
exactly,
wonderful.
Yeah.
Everything's great. Isn't it brilliant? We've privatised all our schools. They're all terrific. And yet in the Bristol scandal rag, the Bristolian, this week, there's a whole different picture being painted. And their headline is "Dodgy Businessman Running Our Schools. Number one is the child killer." And they're talking here about Mr. Price, I'm not sure what his first name is, Peter Price, that's right. He's chair of the Cabot Learning Federation, which runs several schools in Bristol, including Brunel Academy, John Cabot Academy, Hannam Woods Academy, King's Oak Academy, and Bristol Metropolitan Academy. And they're saying that he oversees a disciplinary regime in his schools called isolation, where senior bosses are detaining children in empty rooms on their own with nothing to do all day for minor breaches of school rules. Now, have you any idea, Christine, whether that's true? It just sounds pretty cruel, complete isolation. I mean, that's kind of imprisoning kids.
Well, I'm not aware of the complete isolation, but what I am aware that there's been a change of kind of regime, I suppose, if you like, at Bristol Brunel Academy, and that there is sort of people that work in that school that are not happy with the disciplinary policies that have been brought in by the school. The exclusions have gone up. I mean, permanent exclusions in Bristol have skyrocketed last year. They're the highest that the city has ever recorded. And it looks like this year we're going to have more permanent exclusions from the secondary sector. I mean, if that is what Bristol Brunel are doing, they need to seriously take a look at what their purpose is. Because children's behaviour demonstrate unhappiness and something about how they're feeling about themselves and about how what their emotional state is. And it's no good just telling them off or giving them detention. You need to get underneath what it is that's causing it.
It's worth mentioning that the Brunel Academy have not criticised or have made any legal threats about the facts in this. What they have done is they've said, "You've used one of our photographs in your article." They've sent a threatening letter to the Bristolian saying, "Take that photograph down because it's dangerous to show it," even though, of course, they're showing it on their own website. Worth mentioning as well that Peter Price is also a director of defence aerospace business Rolls-Royce. I mean, this is, Martin, it's something funny going on here. Is big businesses like Rolls-Royce, which obviously has a big role in the defence sector, are now actually in charge of things like disciplinary procedures in our schools?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's no accountability. There's a thicket now of non-governmental organisations, as it were, which are funded with public funds but are not accountable to through any
procedure. It just seems
strange
to me that, you know, the skills you need to produce aero engines for military jets are not necessarily the same, Christine, as what you need to run a school.
No, I would agree. Good education, the skills are around good pedagogy and good teaching and understanding the children.
Pedagogy? Sorry, I have to explain that one.
The scientific term for teaching children. But what this is about is that schools are being run like businesses. So that, I don't know what that man is brought in specifically to kind of add, but on a governing body, you need somebody that has finance skills, you need somebody that has the legal skills, because these schools are also employers, there's also health and safety, that they're an institution, the output is
just
education.
A minute. When you say run it like a business, I mean, you start to think of a kind of production line with a little child sitting on it.
Well, I would suggest that the disciplinary policy of BBA, if what the Bristolian is saying is actually correct and what's going on, then that is their attitude, because it's like we're going to produce children that are going to pass 5 A to C's because that's what we're measured on, and if you don't fit in with that, then we're going to put you in isolation.
Well, look, I mean, sure, that Sir David Carter, Southwest Regional Schools Commissioner now, never mind 10 years ago, but now, would disagree with us, because he had this to say to Points West earlier this week.
I'm very, very pleased with what I've seen happen in Bristol. I think the transformation in Bristol secondary schools is quite remarkable. When you think only 6 years ago, only a third of young people could get five high GCSE grades, and now that's gone to over half. And the fact that 10 years ago Bristol was propping up the local authority league table and is now 21st, I think it's a remarkable success story, and every teacher and leader who works in the Bristol school should be congratulated today by this.
Just drilling into the figures a little bit more, we know that a new school has been built at Redland Green, a very affluent area of Bristol. Other schools that were private have now become state. So has that actually skewed the figures?
Well, it's certainly made a contribution to it, but I think if you take the view that what we're about is trying to make sure that every child in Bristol has a great education, and if that means that schools who were formerly private are now part of the state sector and are contributing to the growth and improvement in Bristol, I think that's a wonderful record. But the main improvement in Bristol has come about as a result of schools that 10 years ago that were performing really badly are now performing amongst the best in the southwest. That's where the true success has taken place, and that's what the future will be built upon.
Now, the results still need some work, don't they, in the league tables. What happens next?
Well, yes, you're right to say that. I mean, the results have now up to 54%. There are parts of the country where those results are stronger, particularly in the London area. But that didn't happen overnight either. And Bristol, what I know about the people who work in Bristol, both in the academies and in the local authority sector, they are not complacent people. They know that the job is not yet done. And my message this evening would be that if you're a parent or a grandparent or a carer and you have a son or daughter in a primary school in the city, you can look forward with real optimism to what the secondary education would look like.
Yes, very much an optimistic view. No tough questions from David Garmston on Points West, though, Christine.
No, I would agree. I think Mr. David Carter needs to check his moral compass, quite honestly. And he also needs to drill a little bit deeper into the data. The 54% is the way it's worked out is you take the headline figure from each of the secondary schools and then you divide it by the number of secondary schools. But the number of children that are taking GCSEs in sort of Brislington Enterprise College, for example, is not the same as the number of children that sit in GCSEs in Colston Girls. So what you've got are smaller number of children getting higher percentages, but that's not taken into consideration. They're not looking at the actual number of children. What they're doing is they're taking the figures from the headline figures from the schools. I would also I want to point out to Mr. David Carter that if we say it's gone from a third to 54%, if we're being generous, we're saying it's gone from 33 to 54, so that's 21% increase. The schools that are now state that weren't state 10 years ago, the Cathedral Choir School, Colston Girls School, the Bristol Free School and Redland Green, they make up 16% of the overall number of secondary school places. So actually, I'm going to suggest it's only gone up 5%, because those are the four schools that take the affluent children from across the city, or in the case of Redland, where they particularly live.
Yeah, but you've got to concede it has gone up.
Yes, on a headline. But what we're saying is, what happens to the children from whom it doesn't go up? What happens to the children that go to BBA and they're not part of that 44%? Well, you know, it's kind of, you need to look underneath what the headline data is, because actually what happens if we get to the point where all of our secondary schools are academised, which we're now at, and it hasn't worked? What happens then? Because actually, That's a really serious situation for the city to be in, isn't it?
Okay, well, you are standing to be the mayor of Bristol. Very brave of you. I asked you this right at the start, but I mean, basically, what's your platform? What do you want to change?
These schools need to prioritise children on free school meals. Every school in the city is now able to do that. It doesn't matter what type of school you are. It doesn't matter if you're a church school, a free school, an academy, or a local authority. You can prioritise children that are entitled to free school meals. And if that happened, we wouldn't have this two-tier socially selective system. And I'm going to argue that actually those schools that are very good, well, if you are that good, you can take more disadvantaged children that need that good education that you're promoting yourselves as offering the students of Bristol.
Well, Christine Townsend, look forward to seeing you battling with George Ferguson for the prime job in the city. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Thank you.
BCFM. Now, Martin, at the top of the hour, very, I suppose, provocative statement, really, from someone who you quote quite a lot on here, who's General Leonid Ivashov, effectively saying that there is no such thing as international terrorism. What he's suggesting is that almost all of the terrorism that's been happening, that we've been seeing since the September the 11th attacks, including the September the 11th attacks themselves, have been cooked up by the West. What planet is this going on?
Well, he's only the head of the Russian armed forces. What does he know, Tony? What sort of access to information does he have? None at all. He's just a conspiracy theorist sitting in his bedroom. He probably doesn't believe that the Americans went to the moon. He's got problems with his mother. He doesn't have relationship problems. That's why he's a conspiracy theorist. Of course, the other thing is to say he was, in fact, head of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, 2001, and has access to all Russian secret intelligence. So there we are.
Well,
pays your money and he takes your choice.
I looked at this article by him from something called the Access of Peace Conference in 2005. What he was saying was, unlike traditional wars, whose conception is determined by generals and politicians, oligarchs and politicians were the ones who are determining the direction of this war on terrorism. He's saying also that only the Secret Services and their current chiefs, or those retiring, have the ability to plan and organise and conduct an operation of such magnitude. Generally, Secret Services create, finance and control extremist organisations. Without the support of Secret Services, these extremist organisations cannot exist.
Well, you heard it from the horse's mouth. What shocks me is that mainstream media in this country and in the rest of the West have not informed the public that this is the view of the Russian general staff, that in actual fact most of the terrorism that's been conducted has in fact been orchestrated by those people. It may not be true, but at least we should know that they're saying
it. The view of a retired general who was chief of staff. He's also saying Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda cannot be the organisers nor the performers of the September the 11th attacks. They don't have the necessary organisation, resources or leaders. Thus, a team of professionals had to be created, and Arab kamikazes are just extras to mask the operation. That's what he said.
Well, that's what he said. And I think people who watch BBC should know that that is the considered view of the chief of staff of the Russian armed forces, who was in fact in charge on the day of the Russian armed forces. And in actual fact, the Russians went to DEFCON 2, I understand, on the day, because they were threatened with a nuclear attack as part of the September the 11th démarche.
One of the things, there's a whole sort of bullet point list of things that he says the term international terrorism has is all about. He said it hides the real objectives of the forces deployed all over the world in the struggle for dominance and control. It turns the people's demands to a struggle of undefined goals against an invisible enemy. It destroys basic international norms and changes concepts such as aggression, state terror, dictatorship or movement of national liberations. It deprives the people of their legitimate right to fight against aggression and reject the work of foreign intelligence services. It also establishes the principle of renunciation of national interest, transforming objectives in the military field by giving priority to the war on terror, violating the logic of military alliances to the detriment of a joint defence and to favour anti-terrorist coalitions. Now, I guess, this is 2005, but this is quite relevant when it comes to Syria now, isn't it?
Of course it is. I mean, we all know, do we not, that Al-Qaeda was created by the Western intelligence services as an Islamic international brigade to fight against the Russian military, or the Soviet military as it then was, operating in Afghanistan. We all know that, don't we? And the official story is that Osama bin Laden, who used to be our best mate, then suddenly went rogue and decided to attack us. And it's a pretty implausible story, but even in that implausible story, the fact that we created Al-Qaeda is not denied. The Saudis, who are our close allies, they keep people in filth and in Christmas box money, they are currently number one supporters of jihadi terrorism around the world. And what we've seen in Syria over the last 4 years is that the Western intelligence services, including our very own MI6, have been up to their eyeballs in supporting jihadi terrorism inside Syria. Is there anybody out there who doubts that that's what's been going on? But at the same time, we then pontificate about people being radicalised online, etc., etc. And Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, pointed the finger at the British for organising the armed uprising inside Syria. Those are the facts. The Russian armed forces former head of the Russian armed forces, accuses MI6 CIA of creating Islamic terrorism. Now, he may be wrong, but the ordinary population in Britain needs to know that that is the considered view of the Russian armed forces.
Of course, this all does become rather more dangerous, what with nuclear weapons nowadays flying around. Of course, it didn't really matter too much, this kind of thing, back in medieval times. But with nukes, it's a whole new story. And I spoke earlier this week to Rose Crossland from Bristol CND, who are organising a meeting next week called Stop Trident, Stop Bombing, because apparently Trident is going to cost us £167 billion for this latest load of nuclear weapons. CND are also organising a talk, as I said, next week on Tuesday, the 2nd of February, at the Trinity Centre. This is that Stop Trident, Stop Bombing. And I spoke, as I said, to Rose Crossland from Bristol's CND earlier this week on dialect.
It's called Stop Trident, Stop the Bombing, and Welfare, Not Warfare. The argument being that the money spent on Trident could and should be spent on other things. And we've got a really good lineup of nationally known speakers coming. First of all, we've got Rebecca Johnson, who is very well known through her work for CND. She's also well known as the founder of the Acronym Institute for Disarmament Diplomacy, and she's worked for decades in the field of international arms negotiations. She was senior advisor to Hans Blix in 2006 on the United Nations WDM committee, for example. And she's also done work very recently on a UN report into the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons. So she's a real expert on the legal background and the diplomatic background to nuclear weapons internationally, and she's a very significant international figure. We've also got John Rees, who is, again, national officer in Stop the War. He's also well known for his role in the People's Assembly Against Austerity. He's coming down from London to speak as well. And we've got Shara Ali, the deputy leader of the Green Party, will be speaking. So that's three national figures. And we also have a good local Bristol voice. We've got Labour Party councillor Mary Threlfall from Eastville, who will be also on the panel. Stop Trident, Stop the Bombing, Welfare, Not Warfare. Nuclear weapons are definitely a special case in the sense that they cannot be targeted. They can only be used as weapons of mass destruction.
Do you think it's possible to get rid of nuclear weapons?
I think in the same way that we've got rid of biological weapons, we've made them illegal. We no longer spend people's tax money on designing and building biological weapons, and we shouldn't be deliberately, as a country, paying our taxes in order
don't
to
governments
design and
just
build
farm
these
this
things.
Sort of work out to private companies now.
But it's our tax money that's being paid for.
I know,
for
but so much of this stuff seems to be being done by private military companies now, and you know, it's all kind of the privatisation of the military is a bit worrying.
Well, Yes, I do agree.
Anyway, just let us know whereabouts and when you meet and when the meeting's taking place.
Yeah, OK, Rose. Well, the speaker meeting is, the public speaker meeting with the national figures is on Tuesday the 2nd of February. It's at 7 o'clock onwards and it's at the Trinity Centre in Easton. And I would like to say that the reason we're holding this speaker meeting now is it's all part of building up towards a massive anti-Trident, anti-nuclear demonstration that's going to be taking place in London on Saturday the 27th of February, so towards the end of February. This is being organised nationally. Even the Telegraph today was saying that they're expecting 50,000 people to be turning up in Trafalgar Square at the end of February to listen to Jeremy Corbyn speak about nuclear weapons. And it's because the government are going to be forcing the vote on whether or not to renew Trident very shortly that this protest is being held now. And everything we're doing at the moment is building towards this big protest. We'll be running buses, coaches from Bristol up to London for the day.
That's Rose Crossland there from Bristol CND. Martin, we should finish just about time maybe for one tiny little item. We could talk about Yemen, but let's just talk a little bit about Arafat actually did ingest polonium. I mean, there's a lot of denials out there on the internet. Litvinenko, what about the role of this guy Mario Scaramella? Do you know anything about him?
Well, it's don't forget that Litvinenko is basically a freelance former Secret Service guy. He definitely was working for MI6 when he was assassinated. And, of course, he's got lots of dodgy mates, and Scaramella's one of them.
The book Blowing Up Russia is a very good NTV documentary about that book, which doesn't mention Berezovsky, but it does show you what happened back in 1999 over in Russia. Absolutely riveting. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time now to sign off. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Up next, Mohammed Makawi and his Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Clifton East, Carla Denyer, and also to Christine Townsend and Nick Much. Thisweek.org.uk takes us straight to this show and archives. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
Niezależnie od pochodzenia, kultury i wiary, wszyscy chcemy najlepszej opieki dla Twojej rodziny i przyjaciół podczas choroby. Ma to ogromne znaczenie, szczególnie dla osób umierających. St. Peter's Hospice w Bristolu jest organizacją charytatywną opieki.